Yeah, so there's a handout on the side of the pews. It's from Ecclesiastes chapter 1, and Ecclesiastes is just one of the books in the Old Testament. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes round to the north. Round and round goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, "See, this is new"? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after the wind.
Great. Thank you, Simeon, for reading for us. And can I add my welcome to Franz? My name's Kev. As you said, I'm the senior minister here at Euston Church. Really, really good to see you. Thank you so much for giving up an evening to come and think about this important subject as we think about finding meaning in a world that often feels so meaningless. The shortest play in the world was written by Samuel Beckett. It's called Breath. Its performance time varies from between 24 seconds to 60 seconds. There are no dialogues or characters or scenes. It's just random rubbish strewn across the stage like that under these big lights. And all the audience hears is the sound of someone breathing in, then breathing out, and that's the end. I was going to play you a YouTube clip of one that I found, but it was a slightly kind of blood-curdling death breath that the person had on that one, so it freaked me out. I decided not to show you it. But that's the whole play, done in under a minute. Apparently, Beckett wrote it in his minimalist phase. Well, yeah, pretty minimalist. And his point was, that's life. You breathe in, you breathe out, that's it. And I guess if you paid money to go and see that at the theatre and felt at the end that you wanted your money back, well, that's probably also the point, because life can feel that way. This is Adam Peaty, British swimming champion. He spoke openly of the post-Olympic blues that he first experienced after winning gold at the Rio Games. He then won double gold at Tokyo before descending into what he called a three-year hell, which he came out of in part from rediscovering Christian faith. Peaty concluded that a gold medal is, quote, the coldest thing you will ever wear, because despite being the pinnacle, it totally failed to address his underlying personal needs. Now, that sort of discontent, you may have read quotes, it's a very common theme among high achievers from the world of sport, celebrity, business. The person speaking here in our reading is called the preacher. He's a king, it says, and clearly also a philosopher. That's a piece of ancient philosophy that you're holding in your hand there. I hope you'll keep holding on to it and look down in it as we explore it for a few moments. I take it in his role as king, he'd seen his share of highs and lows and wars and cost of living crises and scandals. Though this reading expresses feelings that haunt normal people too. Someone told me recently it was when he was doing okay in his job, nice house. It was just at that point when life had got comfortable that he started to ask something along the lines of sentence three. You see it here? What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? What is the point? I don't know how old you are, but have you started to ask that question yet? Well, you're here to think about finding meaning. I want to do a couple of things in this. Mainly in the talk, what I want to do is show us that the God of the Bible gets our angst. And then from there, I want to nudge us towards a journey to find lasting meaning, which the Bible speaks of, and which I'd love us to talk a lot more about in the Q&A. So that Q&A is as important, more important than the talk, because it's your time to take this in whichever direction you please. The thing that makes this guy get all philosophical is that he feels verse 2, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. And he's not using that word vanity in the sense that, you know, you stand in front of the mirror checking yourself out all day. It's that life often feels in vain. The word vain literally means vapor, sometimes translated meaningless. You know the way with a cold morning, you can see a breath out in the cold morning. There's something there, but if you try and capture it in a jam jar, or it's like bubbles. The one in the middle looking the other way is my son a few years ago. By the way, if you ever have to help with childcare in any setup anytime soon, bubbles have this amazing hypnotic effect. I see some of you know this already. So you can go from total meltdown to follow the bubbles in about 2 seconds. It's really very, very powerful. And there's something there. So a child there chasing the bubbles, he's not an idiot. He might actually catch one. But so fleeting, as soon as you reach for it, it's gone. And preacher says we're all in the same business. Whether you're reaching for meaning in academia, work, charity, love, sport, whatever's your thing, you're probably onto something of substance and lots that's good. But verse 14 again, I've seen everything that's done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after the wind. And the reason preacher here feels the meaninglessness of it all is because the world just doesn't seem to be heading anywhere. It just goes round the same cycles. Sentence 4. Generation goes, generation comes, the earth remains forever. Sun rises, sun goes down, hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south, goes round to the north. Round and round goes the wind on its circuits, the wind returns. All the streams run to the sea, but the sea's not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. You hear it? So sun goes up, sun goes down. Wind blows round and round and round. Streams run to the sea. Water goes back to the streams. Streams run to the sea. I don't know if you've ever read William Strauss, Neil Howe, their material. They have this long-standing generational theory that history turns in cycles of about 100 years, with each cycle composed of 4 eras, the last of which is always the most perilous. Their theory says we're in that final crisis era in our 100-year cycle. Well, whatever you think about that at the big level, on the ground, do you ever feel caught up in the sequence, like you're on a fairground carousel? I think starting work over in the city was the first time I really felt this. So you wake up, you go to work, you go home, switch on the TV, switch off the TV, you go to bed. You wake up, you go to work, you come home, switch on the TV. I mean, maybe that's just me, you know, really interesting life that I particularly led. But do you know what I mean? You know how, with the seasons, you feel it, spring, summer, autumn, winter, spring, summer. Oh, it's Christmas again. And now it's Wimbledon time again. And now it's Christmas again. It just kind of goes round and round. And you can call it the circle of life if you work for Walt Disney. But what is the meaning of it? Other than just going round the cycle one more time. Now, at this point, you may want to reply, hang on a minute, Mr. Preacher. Because if after a few of those cycles, I can actually achieve something, a career, family maybe, perhaps I'll even do something significant that makes a real difference in the world. He says, well done. But you never really progress to a place of satisfaction. Verse 8, all things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. Entertain me. Tell me a joke. Show me something new that's gone viral online, because the last trend has already been forgotten. We always want more. And if you're in any doubt that we're all trapped in this cycle, what about verse 9? What has been is what will be. What has been done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it's said, see, this is new? It's been already in the ages before us. You guys are workers. And if you ever stayed up at night and had this great original thought about work, you've written it down in the middle of the night, you go in and tell them about it the next day, and they say, yeah, we tried that 15 years ago and it didn't work. You thought you had a great idea. Or in your studies, you think you've had an original thought for an essay before you find that thought written in someone else's book. And now you've got to actually footnote them because you saw it in their book. How annoying is that? That's the same in the movies. You know, every plot line in film is basically a rehash from either Shakespeare or Star Wars. There's nothing new under the sun. And, of course, this isn't saying that in the olden days they had smartphones and AI and everything that we've got. Some of our advances have been amazing. Life-changing. Remember those COVID vaccines? And at a personal level, we achieve. And yet, the basic stuff of life, relationships, connectedness that's real, work that has lasting value, peace that lasts, death pushed back. None of those instincts really change. And all of them have been chased and frustrated before. Verse 11 is the final depressing nail in the coffin. There's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. This is why we struggle to believe there's nothing new under the sun. It's just that we've got very short memories. We forget the lessons of history that we're supposed to learn from. That's why the politicians think they've abolished boom and bust. They forgot what happened before till there's another bust. I'll make it more personal. Here's a little thing. You can put your hand up for this. Hands up if you could name the first names of your four grandparents. I can do that. So there'll be quite a lot of us that can do that. The four first names of your grandparents. One of mine's called Norman. I don't think you get enough Normans these days. Now keep your hand up. Can you name the first names of your eight great grandparents? That's a bit harder, isn't it? There's always one member of the aristocracy in the room who knows their line all the way back to whatever. But no, virtually none of us can do that. Samuel Beckett got it. Your life is breath. You can aspire to be the healthiest, most loved, most successful 100-year-old in history. But unless you're one in a million, there won't even be a blue plaque on a building in Bloomsbury saying so-and-so used to live here. They won't have time to make a plaque for you because they'll all have moved on to the next cycle. And soon no one will even remember that you ever existed at all. It's cheerful, isn't it? You're glad you came. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. And maybe you disagree with him, think he's just a classic grumpy old man. Age can affect perspective on this stuff. It may be that you need to go around the cycle a few more times to really believe him. But to be honest, I chat to quite a lot of younger adults around here who are fully tuned into the question we are considering tonight. Where do we find meaning? Not a lot of answers in this part of the Bible. Why is this even in the Bible? Well, in part it's affirming, if you do experience the angst, God gets you. The world of religion often encourages us to rise above the pain and frustrating questions or respond to them fatalistically. The God revealed in Scripture meets us in the midst of the frustrations we experience. But more than for empathy, this is designed to burst our over-optimistic bubble about what we can achieve. And I don't mean that cruelly or entirely negatively. The preacher goes on to speak about a contentment in a more simple, humble way than thinking your path to education and career is going to change the world or fulfill your potential. This is expectation management. Life will frustrate you, bore you, and I'm afraid disappoint you sometimes. Because verse 13 here hints at something very important about our world from the early chapters of the Bible. Verse 13 says, notice that second sentence. It's an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. See, life's not just frustrating, frustrated by God as part of what he has given us over to. You want a world unplugged from your maker and his design? God says, well, have that world. And I'd really like you to ask me more about that in the question time. What it means is that vanity and brokenness are structurally inevitable now, unavoidable. This is not just to keep us real, it's to humble us and to drive us to our Maker for answers, which we have no entitlement to, let's be honest. Imagine this was the last word. It would be haunting, wouldn't it, to articulate the human condition so poetically and then have nothing more to say? Be brave and face the absurdity of it all, says atheism. Make up your own meaning, says you do you. Some people have gone to some very dark places when they reflect on the vanity of it all. But there is a hint of more here in the phrase that comes up three times. You may have noticed it. Under the sun, verse 3, verse 9, verse 14. It means the sphere that we exist in under the sky. If your only grid for making sense of life is everything that happens under the sun materially, you'll always struggle to get the point, no matter how good you have it. Could it be that there's more beyond? Could it be that there's a God beyond who made the sun and you and everything? Could it be that this God has set eternity in the hearts of men? That's another phrase from Ecclesiastes. And it speaks to our human uniqueness, because dogs don't write songs about the meaning of life, do they? Cats don't sit around smoking weed philosophizing about a higher purpose. One writer calls us cosmic orphans in the universe, because alone we humans feel the angst. Could it be that this search for meaning comes from a God-given instinct that longs, even knows, there should be more than this? And could there be liberation from the broken cycles that our world never seems to escape? You know, there was another preacher. He was also a king. And he was also in Jerusalem. He came about 1,000 years after this preacher. His name is Jesus Christ. He speaks truth in a world of speculation and disinformation. He speaks to all the things that worry us. We want to belong, make a difference. We want justice done. We want our guilts and shames dealt with. Jesus speaks into all of that. He speaks about a God who made us and who's promised a new world beyond the vain cycles, where things won't be unremembered or dissatisfying or frustrating ever again. Jesus held out a vision of an eternal kind of life where even death and horrible wars on the news, isn't it? Well, in that world, none of it will be able to make a mockery of it all ever again. Don't we want that world? Ecclesiastes says, all is vanity. Jesus says, this is eternal life, that they know you, the only true God. That's the path to meaning. Life plugged back into our Maker. And my own personal experience and my recommendation to you is that you engage with Jesus' offer seriously, urgently. Find meaning through him that lasts into eternity. Thanks for listening.
Hi again. Sorry to break into your conversations. We've had lots of brilliant questions come in. They should be shown on the screen as well. Kev, do come and take a seat, ready for your grilling. A nice, easy one to start off with, but what is the meaning of life then?
I know you all think I didn't answer the question, didn't you? I said it in the last line. Did you not notice? Well, actually, let me say a word of why we did it the way we did it. I find it really compelling that God actually doesn't just come in with a, you know, here's the meaning of life, it's Jesus. He wants to help us really feel what we feel and get that he gets what we feel about the frustration of this world. So there's other bits in the Bible that go in the direction of suffering, but I really like that. I mean, it's some of us really enjoy a bout of existential angst, so you probably enjoyed that. Some of us don't enjoy it. But I enjoyed how much it says to me that God gets what we feel and wants to come to that place and take us on a journey to say, feel the frustration, be gasping for answers. And then, yeah, what is the meaning of life? Well, the thing I quoted right at the end was Jesus from John 17. And by the way, we've got a bunch of John's, mainly John's Gospels, some of them are Matthew's Gospels in your pews. I'd love you to take one of these away. This is really the way to engage with Jesus and his offer. And there's a line in John 17, verse 3, where Jesus says, he's actually praying, he says, this is eternal life, that they know you, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, who you have sent. So the essence of meaning in life is what I said about being plugged back into relationship with our Maker. And that must be right, mustn't it? If we are made creatures, and I know that's some of us take offense at that, you're saying that I'm a made thing. If we have a designer who made us, doesn't it just make sense that the only way you're going to make sense of what a thing is for is to read it in light of the designer's vision and instructions? And the other thing about being made by God is we're not like all the other things he made. You know, I mentioned dogs and cats, but everything else, nothing else is made in his image in the way that we are. So things that are essential to what humanity means and is for actually are about things to do with the nature of God and what he is like. For example, the way that God leads and rules creation. In a mini way, he delegates that job to us. So you won't understand that role, including the frustrations and brokenness of that role, till you plug yourself back into him. Likewise, relationship. Relationship is at the heart of what it means for us to be in the image of God, relationship with each other. You need to go back to him to work out and understand what all that means.
So you're saying that Jesus plugs us back into our Maker. The next top voted question is, what is Jesus' offer and his solution? Is there anything else you want to
say? Well, that's great. Thank you. That's another way of going around the issue. So I would say a few things to that. One is, this John's Gospel, that's the offer and the solution. So the slightly more you'd need to actually do a bit of looking at this answer is read that with a friend, try and make sense of the stuff that he's talking about. Another way to get to grips with Jesus' offer and his solution is a short course that Fran's going to talk about at the end, so we'll leave that to the end. But essentially the offer is, because of this impaired relationship, and there may be another question about this, I don't know, because we're in this impaired relationship with our Maker, what Jesus has to do is to come back to us, to switch on the lights, as it were. We're, for a start, we're kind of in the dark, if we're trying to work it out down here under the sun without reference to our maker. So the first thing he does is he switches on the lights, talks to us about what's real and what's true, talks to us about ourselves, which is uncomfortable because he talks about the ways our hearts are out of relationship with our maker, talks about the way that he's going to have to do a work to forgive us for the ways that we've rejected God, if he's going to be able to bring us back into that relationship. And his solution ultimately is himself. And it's himself on the cross. That's Jesus' solution. Jesus takes all of our failure, guilt, brokenness, rejection of God, takes the consequences and punishment for it on the cross. And that's essentially what enables us to come back into relationship with our maker, in whom we find the light switched on. And I mean, I don't want to drag on.
No, it's great. I mean, the passage that we read talked a lot about this sort of existential angst and these questions.
Yeah.
But what if I don't feel like my striving is in vain?
Well, I want to say, lucky you, that's great. Enjoy that while it lasts. Because I fear that if you live long enough, you will find. I mean, do you know what? When you leave, if you have a job and you leave the job, it's a bit like the grandparents thing. Do you know how quickly it will be before they forget you were ever there in that workplace? I mean, I see someone down here nodding. Has that happened to you, Mark? I'm so sorry. How long was it? 3 minutes? I don't know. But this, you know, this is the kind of existential thing that people reflect on as they get a bit older, you know. Or preacher goes on about this. He starts to talk about, I earned all this money and did quite well in life, preacher says. This is not preacher, sorry, this is John's gospel. Preacher that you were reading about earlier. And then he goes, I've got to leave all my money to the next guy, you know, my son. And he says, and what if he's a total idiot and blows it all? You know, it's these kind of existential things. And then ultimately, death is the thing that means it's a vanity in the end for all of us. You know, that's the ultimate kind of mockery of it all, I'm afraid. So we will increasingly feel the brokenness as we go through life. But where you feel moments of, yeah, not everything's in vain. Some of the stuff we do has real purpose, and some of you will do stuff that really has a powerful, positive effect in the world. Thank the Lord for that. But don't be surprised that it doesn't ultimately work.
Well, actually, this sort of picks up the next question. So someone asks, why does God make us live through this life if it is meaningless?
Yeah, well, it kind of goes back to that line, which might have shocked you when the preacher said, this life that God has given them to. And in the Bible, that's kind of part of God's just judgment, actually, that God gives us over to the world in a sense that we chose. You know, we want to be unplugged from our maker. God says, okay, you can have that world, and he gives us over to that as a just response. Partly what it does, though, as we live through a life that feels meaninglessness, is it's meant to make us cry back out to him. That's what God's about. God doesn't want us to carry on in meaninglessness. That's why he sent Jesus. That's why he gives us, articulates things like the preacher articulates there in Ecclesiastes, to make us go, yeah, what's the answer to this? There must be more. So he's trying to prompt us back towards himself.
You've, I suppose, spoken a bit, but how do we convince people that there is meaning beyond earthly things?
Well, atheism wants to try and persuade us that, you know, really this is a stupid question to ask, isn't it? You know, and you need to always find ways of avoiding the question. But, you know, one of the things about atheism is this is such an ingrained question that people in cultures throughout history and all over the world, whatever's going on in their life, feel this need to think about meaning. And a student said it to me out in the street the other day, said, atheism hasn't supplied spiritually and mentally, you know, what I need. You know, and you could say, well, you're all just looking for a crutch to get you through. Or it could be that there is something ingrained in us. It could be part of what makes us in the image of God. That, as I said, God has put eternity in our hearts. That's what Ecclesiastes says. So there's that way of thinking about it. There's trying to then make sense of some of the other things that atheism, if atheism follows through, it needs us really to suppress things like longing and grief as well, because, you know, it's, if it's all just DNA, grief doesn't make sense, love doesn't make sense. But I would say, I'm afraid atheism not only wants to say there's no God, it actually ends up cutting things out of humanity that seem quite essential to the way we are wired. But ultimately, it comes back to Jesus Christ and saying, look, if you want to be convinced that there's meaning beyond earthly things, let's listen to the one guy who's actually come from beyond the earthly things, come from outside the system, as it were. And he says, there's meaning, there's God, I'm here. And he speaks us about ourselves, him, the future. Only really in his words will we convince people ultimately.
I guess pushing a bit on that, sort of how can you be so sure that this is exactly the meaning of your life? Isn't it just a lifelong gamble?
Well, that's a really good question. And one of the reasons that Jesus commissioned writers like John and Luke to write their gospels is to take the gamble out of it, as it were, for us. So John says this is written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ. He thinks there's evidence. He thinks he's presenting witness, evidence. It's all that kind of language of the courtroom, if you like, to persuade us. So it's not a blind leap of faith. Luke's gospel, I love the way he starts. He says this is written that you may have certainty that Jesus is in the Christ. And I like that word certainty because it says that he gets the fact that I'm not certain. I'm naturally wobbly. So this stuff's written to help take the gamble out of it, as it were. Now, we'll all have our doubts because we are naturally unplugged from God. We'll always struggle to stay connected with him. We'll always be a battle. But Jesus has gifted us with his words to help us to stay on track with him.
How is this different to just like self-help or kind of a crutch to get you through?
Well, it's interesting that thing about a crutch, thank you, because in a way it is a crutch. Who ultimately isn't just kind of fumbling through trying to get through life in the end, you know? So the issue is not, is it a crutch or not? It kind of is a crutch for really needy people. You know, I really need forgiveness. I really need to find purpose. I really need to be reconnected into my maker. So yeah, am I a really needy person? Yeah, I am. And the issue then is Jesus true? And is he speaking to these ultimate needs? And I wouldn't want to take a massive pop at lots of self-help stuff because, do you know, what happens is when people do unplug from their maker, what you find, and you could look for this, it's such an interesting thing. People and cultures then start to recraft things that look like religious structures almost in their life around, whether that's around community, or whether that's around mindfulness. You know, mindfulness is quite a kind of cool thing now. Well, that's, yeah, we've been doing it for thousands of years as Christians, you know, meditating on what's really true, praying to God, reflecting, all of that. So I don't want to knock all of that stuff. I think sometimes it's actually trying to copy Christianity.
Saying that there's sort of nothing new under the sun, is that not trivializing the advancements of mankind, like modern medicine, art, technology, etc.? Perhaps one day humans might be able to live forever.
Yep, thank you. So that's a good question. I don't want to trivialize the advances that we've had. So sorry, I'm going to say sorry if I did do that, because aren't we all so grateful for them? You know, stuff like the COVID vaccines. That was extraordinary how quickly that all emerged when you think of previous pandemics through history. So in the Christian worldview, plugged into our maker again, we would say, well, it's because people are made in the image of God and the creativity and ingenuity that God has given that have enabled these advances. The problem with it all is we never really move away from our fundamental problems of isolation and lack of peace. I mean, it's just tragic, isn't it? I don't know if maybe you can't cope with going onto the phone at the moment. I mean, it's just tragic. It's, you know, war, peace that lasts seems to be completely unattainable for us as a humanity. It's absolutely tragic. And the way that death always interferes in the end. And I want to say partly yes and no to that last comment about humans living forever. God has promised that in this world that will not be possible, because death is actually the ultimate judgment for our rejection of our maker. So it's an interesting thought that every time you lower a coffin into the ground, That's actually a testimony to the faithfulness of the word of God, that he said that's what would happen if we ignored him, I'm afraid. Wonderfully, in Jesus, in the gospel, living forever is exactly. So again, you've got that urge. It's in, you know, you're expressing an urge that's there. It's a right urge, and it can be fulfilled in Jesus, who again says, this is written so that you may believe, and by believing may have life in his name, and that's an eternal life.
If life, and maybe you've answered this already, but if life is in vain, should we just give up?
Well, that's an option, yeah. I was just thinking, another one that Paul presents in the book of 1 Corinthians is, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. So, you know, he says that's another option if it's all not true. And if everything really is in vain, well, that's the kind of just enjoy yourself option. Let's all go down to the pub. You could slightly make that more sophisticated, you know, and let's try and sort of throw yourself into philosophy or sport or art, knowing that it's all ultimately in vain, but enjoying it along the way. But that, yeah, so you're expressing something there that is kind of logical if it turns out that there's no God and no ultimate meaning.
Just a couple more questions. Is aiming to make a legacy, so sort of a Christian heritage, for my future family, therefore futile and pointless? Should that not be a focus?
Yeah, no, it's not. And again, that's the kind of urge in us, isn't it, to have a legacy? And I take it you mean more than, you know, money, you know, Christian heritage. You know, that's a powerful thing to pass on down the generation. I got to speak. I had the privilege of speaking at my grandmother's funeral, and one of the things I said was, "What a blessing to have this Christian heritage that Granny passed down to us." So that has real purpose and meaning. That has meaning because it's plugged back into its maker, though. So it's a Christian purpose because it's connected to things that will last into eternity, and other, you know, it's family life generally is a blessing, whether people are Christian or not. I think what Mr. Preacher would say back to us again, though, is just don't overestimate how much you are going to be able to achieve. And I'm afraid that so many of us have heard from school that you're going to fulfill your potential and be able to achieve what you want, and I'm afraid it's not true. And that's what Mr. Ecclesiastes Preacher wants us just to be real about.
I guess, so we've done lots of philosophizing and thinking, but what is the practical application of today's talk?
Yeah, that's it. What do you think, Fran? Where are you landing on this? I don't know.
Well, partly I would take one of those John's Gospels that Kev mentioned about and actually read Jesus' words for himself. I think Jesus would say that's the practical application, to hear him and hear what he says and to critically examine and to really think about that and decide where you land. That would be.
And mine would be, take it back to the previous question. The practical application is get real about this world, actually, and what's achievable. And from that place, be driven to look for bigger, longer, lasting solutions.
Okay, so final question. Someone said it's been a sort of beautiful experience for them, finding Jesus. Could you share something of your experience?
Oh, thank you. That's a great place to land, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about Jesus. I'd love you to get into John's Gospel and to look at him. The character of Christ in a world of religious hypocrisy shines so much. The things that he's capable of, just sheer power, but always with unbelievable compassion at the same time. This combination of power and compassion I find hugely compelling. And then his servant-heartedness that takes him all the way to the cross for people like you and me who didn't deserve that at all. You know, it astonishes me that Jesus would be that committed to a mission that was driven around people like me, undeserving me. So, and that servant leadership, you know, that changed the world. The reason we have this concept of servant leadership in the world is because of Jesus Christ, basically. It's absolutely beautiful when you see him in action. So I've never yet found anyone, and the way he speaks, he's the ultimate anthropologist. He speaks about us more clearly and incisively than anyone else. So I'm not dissing other spiritual leaders, and you know, there's plenty of significant people, but there's only ever been one Jesus, and I hope that as you get into looking at this, you really would find that yourself.
Kev, thank you very much, and thank you for answering those questions.